You're listening to Humanities Viewpoints, a podcast from the Humanities Institute at Wake Forest University. I'm your host, Assistant Director Amy Meppam. Today I'm talking with Dr. Charles Wilkins, Wake Forest Associate Professor of History, Wake Forest Senior Reed Simpson, and Dr. Anka Sharis. Dr. Sharis is an internationally recognized conservator specializing in Islamic art and currently living in Germany. She is visiting Wake Forest as a scholar in residence from February 10th through the 20th. The focus of her attention will be a space in Greyland Manor House known as the Persian Card Room, an early example of an Ottoman residential space dating from the early 18th century. The panels decorating the room were acquired by Reynolds Tobacco Company President Bowman Gray and his wife Natalie Lyons Gray during their tours of the Mediterranean in the 1920s. During her stay, Dr. Sharis will personally examine the Persian Card Room. Since early 2019, she has been conducting research on the room remotely by using an online gallery of digital images provided by university photographer Ken Bennett. Her personal examination is intended to verify her initial findings. Dr. Sharis will also present two public lectures. The first, The Persian Card Room at Greyland Estate, Secrets of a Rare Interior from Damascus Revealed, will take place at 5 p.m. on Tuesday, February 18th in the auditorium of Rinalda House Museum of American Art. The second, Relatives of the Persian Card Room at the Greyland Estate, Damascene Rooms and Collections Around the World between 1880 and 2020, will take place at 5 p.m. on Wednesday, February 19th, also in the auditorium of Rinalda House Museum of American Art. Don't miss these great opportunities, and please visit history.wfu.edu for more information. These events are sponsored by the WFU Center for Global Programs and Studies, the History Department, the Art Department, the Department for the Study of Religions, the Middle East and South Asia Studies Program, and the Humanities Institute, with support made possible by a major grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Dr. Anka Sharis is the author of the book Damascene Ajami Interiors, Forgotten Jewels of Interior Design. She is a conservator specializing in polychrome wooden surfaces with a special interest in Islamic art. She has a PhD from the Academy of Fine Arts in Dresden, Germany, and she has been engaged in research and conservation of Syrian Ottoman interiors for many years, both in museum collections and in historic houses in Germany, New York, and Damascus. Charles Wilkins joined the Wake Forest faculty in 2006 as Assistant Professor of Middle Eastern History. He is the author of Forging Urban Solidarities, Ottoman Aleppo, 1640 to 1700. Wilkins' scholarly work is concerned with the social history of the Ottoman Empire in the early modern period, 1500 to 1800. His current research focuses on the long-term social and cultural integration of the Arab lands in the Ottoman Empire. Reed Simpson is a senior at Wake Forest University. He plans to enter a graduate program in history after graduation. He has been working with Dr. Wilkins as a research assistant on this project. In this episode, we discuss the origins of the panels of the Persian Card Room, the history of art collection in wealthy families like the Greys, and the poets who wrote the inscriptions on the panels, as well as other topics. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thank you all for being here and talking with me today. I'm wondering if, to start with, one of you could maybe give just a little bit of background information on the Persian Card Room, just sort of general information, and then I'd like to talk to each of you about what led you to this work, you know, what was particularly interesting to you, and with your, you know, to your field about the exploration of this room and its significance.
Well, the Persian Card Room is a room that I came to know while I was here at Wake Forest, and as a member of the history faculty, would occasionally encounter, but was always led to a certain silence or a certain, a brick wall. Mm-hmm. I was led to a brick wall because I could not go beyond a certain point. I could describe it as Arabic, I could describe it as Middle Eastern, but mm-hmm. beyond that, I could not really describe it beyond that or explain it to anyone. So the starting point for my interest in this project mm-hmm. was that a former member of the history faculty now at the University of Pennsylvania was visiting, giving a lecture at Wake Forest. Mm-hmm. And he was staying at Greyland. Mm-hmm. And he said to me, we were walking through the room, and he said, Charles, you know, you should really do something about on this room,
right? Yeah. Right?
He had already left. Right. He had left. He said he thought he'd sort of pass it on down. You should probably do this. And, because it is in that period of history in which I specialize, the social history of the Ottoman Empire, of the middle period, 17th, 18th right. century. So I was drawn to it because the people who occupied that room were the people that I had studied in other sources, court records in particular. So I felt a natural affinity for the room for that reason and wanted to bring on board a professional art historian but, and also see if an undergraduate student could work with me, because it's also an American story because the Grays themselves would commission the installation of the room.
Right.
Yeah, for me the story began almost a year ago on the day. Yeah. I received an email from the director of the Museum of Islamic Art from Berlin. I was in CC, and it was actually an email from Charles to Stefan Weber, who was the director. They both knew each other from 20 years ago, time in Damascus. And the email was about the origin of the room, whether Stefan could say something about it. And he identified it immediately as being from Damascus, as well as I did when I saw the images. I was totally thrilled because there aren't so many rooms in collections abroad. And there were certain elements that I spotted that are very rare. And the style of some of the frameworks, and then particularly the date that Charles discovered already, so it means it's made in 1700, or some parts of it. So and from this moment, I wanted to see this room really impatiently. So that's why I'm really glad that it just took a year to get me here. So I'm totally thrilled, totally blown away since I'm here.
Thank you.
Well, I think it was about spring semester of my sophomore year, I believe. I really didn't want to spend the summer at home, so I had taken a few classes with Dr. Wilkins already, who'd been really interested in his histories of the Middle East and the Ottoman Empire, and so I approached him and asked him if he was pursuing any research that he might need an undergraduate to assist him with, and he told me about his project, and I was sold. And I was really, really eager to help out, and I'm glad I did. This has been really an interesting project.
Well, I mean, he also knows Arabic, and so the combination of his interest in Middle Eastern history and his knowledge of Arabic meant that we could work together on some aspects of the room. So I was doubly pleased with that.
Yeah,
being modest, he was being modest.
Thank you for coming.
So yeah, can we talk about the origin of the room a little bit? Because I think it was, you know, not initially known, right, to be from Damascus. So how did that sort of become uncovered?
Well, I'll tell you the conventional wisdom,
right,
was that it was called the Persian card room.
Right,
because I think that the Gray family called it that. And that name stuck, right? It was called Persian. It was called card because I think they play cards in it. And Reed and I took from that they maybe gambled in the room. But, you know, we don't...
It was popular for bridge games.
So that is a conventional sort of naming of the room, but that masks a much more interesting history, I think.
I'm involved in research and conservation of interiors from Damascus for more than 20 years now. So I've seen about 200 around the world, including Damascus, maybe like 150 houses in Damascus. So my photographic memory, how to say, can detect, you know, objects like the Persian card room, because houses in Aleppo, in Istanbul, in Hama, they do look different. So, and I can even detect certain workshops that produced certain numbers of rooms. So when I saw the first images that Charles sent me of that room, it was immediately clear that it's Damascus, there's no doubt. And the more insights I became, the more fascinated I became as well, to see, okay, some elements are 1700, some of them are 1810, 1820, and by the size and then the architectural layout of certain elements, it's clear what it was before. Some were wall cabinets, some were entry doors, some were open wall niches, but now they are all assembled together, pieces from at least 6 interiors in houses in Damascus. So what I realized yesterday after spending 2 days really of intense work mm-hmm. in that room, mm-hmm. It became pretty clear that it was assembled in Damascus by a kind of restoration company mm-hmm. in the early 20th century to be set up for sale for an antique dealer in Istanbul, obviously. Mm-hmm. And I believe that the room was set up in Istanbul as it is installed today. And this is the place where I guess that the Greys saw it and just purchased it right away.
Right.
Because all the changes and amendments of wood connections, it's from one hand, from one moment. Mm-hmm. So it's impossible that it could have been done here in America, for example.
Right.
You need to have the material and knowledge of these people who are familiar in producing these kind of panels and painting technique
yeah.
or decorative technique. So it's pretty clear that it could be only Damascus.
It's really fascinating.
Thank you.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm so thrilled.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, could you say again, I'm sorry, just to make sure I got this, where they may have been taken from, like the panels and compiled then?
Yeah. Yeah, one element, for example, that it's now called like the Qibla or the like,
mm-hmm.
not prayer niche, but something like that.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually a window to the courtyard
of an
affluent family
mm-hmm.
in Damascus
mm-hmm.
with a huge residence. And it's filled now with pieces that were once like long vertical panels that were sitting between windows or shelf niches.
Okay.
And one element that looks weird because it has not all these, you know, flower decoration,
mm-hmm.
it's geometric.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually an entry door of an original room. And now it's sitting somewhere on a weird place in the wall.
Right, yeah.
And the ceiling also has elements that were installed in the first place on walls, not on ceilings,
mm-hmm.
because there's no inscription panels of that particular type
mm-hmm.
that would be ever found in a ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty clear. And then if you study the wood connections, you can see what they changed to make it, you know, this new assemblage.
Yeah.
But the alternation of medallions and cartouches gives a lot of hints to figure out where the original pieces were located.
Yeah.
So it's like a little bit Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah, but finally, yeah. I mean, it was really fascinating to see that it's even possible to find the layout of the room as it existed in 1700 in Damascus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And one other thing that I spotted yesterday is that the date 1700, it's clearly related to these panels
right.
that surround these inscription panels, because it's easy to mix them up
mm-hmm.
in a way, but
mm-hmm.
it's clear from the nail holes and wood connections that it really belongs together.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no other room preserved of that early date with this type of decoration.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very early with flower cartouches and flower
yeah.
vases.
Right.
And most of the relevant literature about these type of objects, they say that these rooms are influenced by the famous library of Ahmed III in Istanbul
mm-hmm.
in the Topkapi Palace. But this room is even 3 years earlier than this famous library.
Wow.
So it means that this style was already present in the Ottoman provinces, if you wish.
Right.
There's another room in Cairo, Betharawi, that has a similar ceiling dated 1708.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it's full of these flower vases.
Right, yeah.
So among these, and there's only one other early object. This is the Damascus room of the Metropolitan Museum of Art,
mm-hmm.
dated 1708. So among these three objects, the Persian card room really stands out as a really important piece because
yeah.
there's nothing preserved with the style.
In your research, you know, how was it impacted? I imagine it was greatly by moving from, you know, looking at pictures online to being here in person and seeing those, you know, connections between the panels. Could you maybe talk a little bit about that process?
There were already high resolution photography
mm-hmm.
of the room, which was a basic tool, it's very essential.
Yes.
and I could really zoom in.
Yeah. Okay.
And with my experienced eyes, I could already detect certain cracks and joints
mm-hmm.
that obviously are later.
Mm-hmm.
And even in these images, I could see that the damages on the 1920 pieces that were added look very different than the original ones. But now, being in the room,
right.
I could confirm certain things. And I could go ahead with, observations where I got stuck just looking
mm-hmm.
at the images.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really essential being here
mm-hmm.
and, you know, finding out what's true.
Right.
And what
yeah.
is just like, sometimes, I wish I would see something.
Yeah.
And I have to
yeah.
make
yeah.
sure that I don't betray myself.
Yeah.
So.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I was just going to say, we're grateful to University photographer Ken Bennett
yes.
for,
yeah.
for,
yeah.
for,
yeah.
for
providing
that,
the images.
That
yeah.
Gallery.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah.
And what is nice about it, it can really take you to a travel through certain periods of
right.
home decor, if you wish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you explain it to the public, it's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there are certain motifs that depict precious textiles, patterns of Indian embroideries, of Iranian silk fabrics.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go ahead with that, it's very interesting to relate it to objects of that period
right.
and what was highly in fashion at a certain moment of time
mm-hmm.
in that place.
Yeah.
So this is what I really like about
yeah.
it.
I want to talk about the collection of this piece. In your opinions, why were wealthy families like the Greys interested in collecting particular kinds of art from the Islamic Middle East? Particularly, why focus on the recreation of an interior space like this rather than just the accumulation of other artifacts and art objects? So,
in my research, after the Civil War, as America was moving into the early 20th century, a lot of people, wealthy families, began looking back outward towards Europe and the Near East. And as this was happening, we see a lot of, there were a lot of wealthy families who would travel to the Middle East, and from there they would, they would come back and they would want to sort of build up, I guess, it's almost like having a souvenir.
Mm-hmm.
You want to show people where you've been, what your experiences there were like.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that, especially there were early examples like Frederick Church, who lived in the Middle East. I believe it was Syria for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And he comes back and he builds a house in upstate New York, Olana, which is this fabulous recreation designed on the places he has visited. And from there, this trend sort of spread to other wealthy families. We got Doris Duke's Shangri-La in Hawaii. And I think it was a trend among wealthy families at this time, especially. It was a way of not only sort of displaying your wealth, obviously, and this was a very expensive venture, but also your cultural knowledge, your
sure.
experience,
a sort of cosmopolitan.
Yes, very very
yeah.
cosmopolitan.
Yeah.
You know, I've looked where I've been. You know, look at all these places I've
mm-hmm.
seen, these people I've experienced. Especially with the sort of focus on, I think, the recreation of like a room.
Mm-hmm.
We see there were a lot of what were called like Turkish like lounges
mm-hmm.
Was a big sort of style. And that's because I think Turkey was exporting a lot of tobacco
mm-hmm.
to America at the time. And we see that with the Reynolds Company used a lot of Turkish tobacco in their cigarettes, which is part of the reason why we suspect, you know, the Greys were visiting Turkey and
yeah.
Istanbul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But, and so that's where you get sort of the Turkish smoking room,
mm-hmm.
the Turkish smoking lounge.
Yeah, I it's interesting that not only the content of the materials used to make the cigarette, but the fact that the Reynolds family named a brand of cigarette Camel. Plays on this American, this fascination with the Middle East, beyond the elite class to a much broader segment of the American public. And I think they were seeking to play on America's dreams to escape, you know, to find some kind of exotic other land to when they smoke, they are also escaping to the Middle East. It's sort of the creation of modern advertising.
And to add on to that, interestingly, I found out recently in a book I've been reading through on the Reynolds Tobacco Company, before Camels, they had another brand of cigarettes called Osman cigarettes. With a picture on the box or container of cigarettes of a Turkish general. But just even more on the nose than
And Osman being the Ottoman form of the Turkish form of Ottoman.
Right.
But I could speak also now to the inscriptions in the room, if that's.
I'd love to move. I'd love to talk about that. The poets in the time period that are represented there, and also I'm interested in what your thoughts are on what the Greys may have thought of those inscriptions. You know, if that's known.
Conventional knowledge, the conventional wisdom is that. The panels were taken from a small mosque, right, in Istanbul, right? And the implication being that it is a room for religious purpose, and that the verses themselves are from the Quran, and this is taken directly from the History of Greyland pamphlet. It is true that they are religious,
right?
But that is about the only thing that is, you know, correct,
right?
And,
yeah.
And that this room, as I understand from Akka's and others' interpretation, is a residential interior.
Right, yeah.
And was not a mosque interior.
Right.
But that the original patrons of this room were nonetheless themselves Muslim and were probably devout because of the choice of the poetry that they commissioned. And so the poetry, if we consider just the walls of the poetry, if we consider just the walls of the room, they are made up of a single poem, right, by a 12th century Moroccan Muslim scholar who in this poem is basically praying to God for intercession in a moment of need or crisis. And this is not simply meant for a moment, but for everyone who is there, that the room, as I argue, is a kind of sacral space or has a kind of talismanic quality to it that people who inhabit it, in fact, can gain benefit, can gain blessing, and have their own prayers answered. So I think that suggests that even if it is not a mosque in a strict sense, it was used, it had a strong religious meaning to it and was likely commissioned by a Muslim family. And that is not true of all, you know, rooms. There were Christian families, right, who commissioned Damascene rooms.
And Jewish as well.
We shouldn't necessarily associate it with Islamic culture itself, or a broader Arab or Ottoman culture. I just thought, you know, it's important to, you know, set the record straight in terms of determining the provenance of those verses, and I'm somewhat intrigued by the strong North African Egyptian sort of origins of the poetry in the room. If we consider the poetry of the walls and of the ceilings as well, if the ceiling in fact was part of the original room, we can't quite establish that, I think. The fact is that most of those poems poets represented are either from Morocco or from Andalus or from Spain or from Egypt. I'm wondering whether the people who commissioned this might have been immigrants from North Africa to Damascus, you know, and there's a long history of migration of North African Muslims eastward to Damascus. So there's a strong, interesting trans-regional quality to this room, I would suggest. That's just a working hypothesis for us.
Yeah, and as far as I know, Damascus was also, of course, a hub of commerce.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, families from, you know, certain regions had like one cousin sitting in Damascus, another in Baghdad, mm-hmm. another one in Tehran, in Istanbul, in Cairo, mm-hmm. in Morocco, maybe. Mm-hmm. So it was like their family network for the merchants, as far as I know. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised, you know, finding so many different inscriptions and, you know, poetry in Damascus, because it was a melting pot.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't really important where you're from. You just were contributing to the wealth of the city,
mm-hmm.
of the well-being of the city. This mm-hmm. is how I understand mm-hmm. these kind of rooms,
yeah,
in a
yeah.
way.
Am I correct? There are four poets whose works appear somewhere in the panels.
That's right.
And yeah, could you maybe talk a little bit about? I'm especially fascinated because one is a woman, right?
Right.
And that was interesting to me to learn too. So yeah, could you maybe say just a little bit about? It will probably connect to what you've already said about, you know, the origins of the poets.
So two of the poets are basically writing poetry that are praying to God for intercession,
right.
So prayers of supplication. Mm-hmm. And one of them is this Suheili, this North African
mm-hmm.
Andalusian scholar, and the other is this woman, Hani al-Abbasiyya,
mm-hmm.
who was a Moroccan, of a Moroccan scholarly family.
Mm-hmm.
And she likely acquired her learning because she was a member of a scholarly family,
mm-hmm.
and biographical dictionaries of that period of the 15th century in which she lived identify her as one, as a learned a jurist,
mm-hmm.
and a relative of other, a kind of dynasty of scholars,
mm-hmm.
if you will. So they have a, they're united by that theme.
Mm-hmm.
The other two poets are much more about praise of the Prophet Muhammad.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And these are Ibn al-Farid, who is a famous Sufi poet, and al-Busiri,
mm-hmm.
Whose greatest fame is that he wrote probably the greatest poem in the Arabic language, the most popular poem in the Arabic language, al-Burda, the mantle, if you will, the mantle of the Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
And those two poems are, again, you know, narratives that laud the Prophet, but in a way that is mystical in intent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is, Muhammad is not only a prophet, but he's the beloved of the worshiper who loves him and loves God.
Mm-hmm.
And those worshipers of God seek to know God and to become one with him by reading this kind of poetry,
mm-hmm.
right, and enjoying
right.
it and,
yeah.
and celebrating it and reciting it. And so those poems are, you know, raising up Muhammad as an exemplar of piety and insight and knowledge, you know, as a hero also in his history. So it's an interesting, you do have a wide range of
right.
poets represented. And the fact that one is a woman
mm-hmm.
is, I think, exceptionally interesting,
mm-hmm.
because there are so few women represented in the written record. They might have been important reciters on a day-to-day basis in a kind of informal oral tradition, but in a written literary, high literary tradition, fairly few women are actually exercising that kind of role.
Yeah. I'm wondering too, and again, this might just be, you know, us speculating, but how much is known, or, you know, about their relationship to the religious nature of the inscriptions on the panels. I mean, did they have any sense of, and I'm also thinking too of, you know, this being a place where, you know, gambling might have been occurring, you know, was there any sense of irony there? Like, what, you know, where are they, where is anything known about that?
Not really.
Yeah, yeah. I had a feeling that was the answer.
Answer,
yeah.
That's one thing that's been a little frustrating,
sure.
in this research, is that there's not a whole lot recorded about the personal lives of Bowman and
mm-hmm.
Natalie Gray.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I just mainly had to sort of get my information from the people around them. Like, I interviewed Tom Gray, who was there.
I think a nephew.
Okay.
Yeah.
And literature about sort of their relations through the Reynolds family
mm-hmm.
and to other wealthy American families. because there's not much about the individuals.
Right, right.
So,
mm-hmm. I was just going to add that the archival work that,
mm-hmm. yes.
That Reed has been doing in the ZSR library
right.
has unfortunately yielded little in terms of that
right.
interior
yeah,
family
yeah.
history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wonder if, you know, the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company and its archives, because it was sort of on a business trip, if
right.
he was
yeah.
looking, sampling tobacco,
yeah.
maybe that might have ended up there.
Right.
And those kinds of archives are difficult to access.
Yeah. yeah. Yeah.
So, unfortunately, I
yeah.
think that we are at somewhat of a pause
sure.
on that front.
Okay. But,
yeah, I want just to share one thought or
sure.
one experience collected by
mm-hmm.
time. It's that I think the question always on the religion and on the faith of the people, it's not so important as
mm-hmm.
we think today, because
mm-hmm.
for these people it was given that everybody had a faith.
Right.
And it wasn't, especially in a city of commerce, it wasn't really that important. And as far as I know, people also converted and,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's one part of the daily life in a way,
mm-hmm.
even this devotion. That's why it's interesting to
mm-hmm.
see which verses they pick.
Right.
And of course, these calligraphy panels in the room are the most important decoration
mm-hmm.
feature.
Yeah.
And of course, the owner builder has a particular interest in choosing a particular poem or other inscription.
Right.
So I'm sure there's a lot of decision and thoughts about it, what to pick from the thousands of possibilities you have. And that's why it's, you know, very interesting why they pick what.
Yeah.
And as far as I learned, it's also that these verses were used to, you know, start conversations and inspire guests, either business guests, family guests, whomever, if a scholar visits. And I also had an encounter once in the room in Dresden where I worked for many years. A Syrian came, and we actually have a poem by Al-Ghazali, also 12th century.
Mm-hmm.
And he immediately starts singing it.
Mm-hmm.
So he was like, wow, because some people know these
yeah.
poems
mm-hmm.
by heart, and
right.
they also, you know, are able to sing it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we also should imagine that like performances like this would happen occasionally
mm-hmm.
in these rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So it's part of daily life.
Yeah.
With, you know, different connections.
Could you maybe talk a little bit more about sort of the daily life, and also perhaps the not just the construction of putting the panels together as they were, but the original creation of them, and sort of the materials and the process?
I mean, these traditional courtyard houses, the heart is in courtyard,
mm-hmm.
and most houses have an interior courtyard and an outer courtyard. And the rooms are located surrounding the courtyard. It means that these houses have many of these, between 6, 7, 8. The wealthy families have even a house with 7 or 11 courtyards,
mm-hmm.
with like 30 rooms.
Right.
So, but the most important rooms are the reception rooms for guests, because this is like, if you wish, semi-public
mm-hmm.
places.
Mm-hmm.
Where people from outside the family would come,
mm-hmm.
either business or, you know, scholars or whomever from the society, to bargain about whatever, or even they would hold court. The Qadi would come to the house and, you know,
mm-hmm.
would help solving issues.
Mm-hmm.
So these rooms have like a multifunctional purpose. But the general structure is that you have like an entry space that is covered with marble mosaic,
mm-hmm.
and then you take off your shoes and you step up on a raised seating platform that is covered with precious carpets, cushions, like a low divan,
mm-hmm.
and the walls are equipped with this kind of wall paneling and the ceiling high above.
Mm-hmm.
And the ceilings and the rooms are usually between 5 and 10 meters tall. And when the rooms were transformed to be these orientalizing fantasy objects.
Right.
They were really adapted to fit the smaller size spaces in the Western Hemisphere.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one reason why we don't find the huge original rooms in collections abroad.
Right.
And the rooms were equipped with windows to the courtyard that people could look out what's going on and to get fresh air
mm-hmm.
from the courtyard into the room. Don't forget it's a desert climate.
Right, yeah.
So,
right.
And then you would have wall cabinets where belongings of the family would be stored. Very important are open shelf niches, small ones where valuable items could be displayed, like metal objects, china, porcelain, anything valuable they, you know, possess in the family. And in many rooms, the main wall has a large open niche, which puzzled me a long time to understand what that is, because rumors are many. And then I learned that this obviously was a place where the folded bedding was stored, because everybody, being a guest or family member, would just go in the evening,
mm-hmm.
take one of these 20 or 30 bedding
mm-hmm.
Stuff and
yeah.
would go, you know, to sleep wherever it's convenient,
mm-hmm.
whether on the roof terrace, in the courtyard, or in one of these rooms.
Mm-hmm.
And the more precious and expensive bedding material you could show off as a family, you would also quietly show off your wealth. So it's very important and very interesting if you look at the Persian card room, because we have two frames that once were these kind of large
yeah,
niche, for
right.
example.
Yeah.
Now they are both the doors
mm-hmm.
to the adjacent rooms,
right.
Filled with doors of original wall cabinets where you wouldn't go through. You would just open it and store
right.
stuff. So
yeah.
that's why it's, you know,
that's
very
interesting
to
yeah.
see, you know, how they play with elements
right.
to, you know,
yeah.
reassemble it to fit the needs of
mm-hmm.
the potential customers.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
It's just fascinating.
Yeah. And you're going to be speaking about some of the other rooms
mm-hmm.
that are similar to this around the world. Can you remind me how many there are? I mean, roughly. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe 30.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
If you, I mean, there's a collection in Beirut
mm-hmm.
where 16 rooms are filled with objects,
yeah.
but I just recently heard that they obviously are sold off.
Right.
So,
mm-hmm. yeah.
So, and other collections own like 2 or 3 rooms.
Mm-hmm.
So, but in total, I think 30.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And 5 at least are in the United States, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, New York.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, NYU in New York as well.
Uh-huh. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And 2 in Honolulu, in Doris Dukes,
yeah.
mm-hmm. Shangri-La.
Yeah.
Yeah, and another one was bought recently by LACMA,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to be on display in Los Angeles
okay.
mm-hmm.
soon.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then another one in Canada, in the Aga Khan Museum in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the one you have, it's just amazing because it's so early.
Yes.
I really have to.
Yeah.
It's the mother of all Damascus.
Not the mother, but a very important, grandson, I would say. Yeah.
is that just, yeah, I mean, the fact that the Greys ended up with this very early example, is that just, I mean,
it's coincidence. It's,
yeah, just, mm. just accident. Yeah, okay, yeah.
But it's important in a way because most of the houses that still exist in Damascus
mm-hmm.
Were built after heavy earthquakes that happened in 1759.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why most of the rooms that are spread out
right.
in the world
mm-hmm.
are dated between 1770 and 1820.
That's really interesting.
So, and that's why there are anyhow very few preserved from the time before these earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally, one made the way to
yeah.
The Gralian Estate.
Yeah.
So it just makes me goosebumps.
I know.
So, and it could be interesting to see, even in court records from Damascus, which houses were not destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we could narrow down areas
oh,
of the city
yeah. mm-hmm.
where the room could
yeah.
be resourced in a way.
Yeah.
There are probate inventories dating from around the turn of the 18th century. I mean, they're among the very earliest of the court records that our colleagues, Jim Grehan, mm-hmm. has studied, that I don't know, I'd have to check with him and get his view on it, because his book does comment on, you know, the Damascene Rim as a very short discussion on, you know, it as an object of an elite consumption and not really the preserve of most Damascenes. But I think there's much more to the sources that he used.
Yeah. What's next for this project? Where does the research go from here?
Well, our plan is to produce a pamphlet for use and distribution by the Graylin Conference Center in the short term. It would be an illustrated pamphlet that will be of value to people who are curious about the room. And I think that is our short-term goal. A longer-term goal, not yet clearly defined, but we do want to, we see this room as Anka has pointed out, as a significant historical discovery, and that it could, you know, constitute the basis for a scholarly article in a journal, I don't know, in Mulcarnas, or I don't know if that's something that could be possible, but it's clearly, we aim it for both a popular audience in the short term and for a scholarly readership in the longer term.
What's the sort of main takeaway you would like for, you know, an audience to have about the importance of this room and the interest in this room?
I think it's the room is small, pretty small, but it's an unfolding universe of a lot of different things. The inscriptions, the paintings, it's little landscapes from Istanbul. It's these textile patterns that were valuable objects. I always explain it in a way, if you look at a watch and you see it's a Rolex, you know how much money you need to spend on it. Mm-hmm. And these textiles that were painted in these rooms have a similar function. So they are very precious, but for us today, it's difficult to decode them, if you wish. Mm-hmm. So, and these kind of things could be, you know, very interesting to understand what people look at. Mm-hmm. So this, it's one goal I would have, to, you know, take people to a time travel, to a place to travel in a way, because it's hard to go to Syria right now for most of us. And on the other hand, it's also, I have so many friends still there.
Right.
They always ask me to tell stories about their rich heritage and their beauty, because most people just see the images in the news with destroyed and dead people. So, but millions of them, they are still alive and they struggle with their daily life and they have their pride and their, you know, their pride being, you know, Damascenes or other beings. Mm-hmm. So, and this, for me, it's an important part of it.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you all for being here. This was a lovely conversation. I really learned a lot. So thank you very much.
That was Reed Simpson, Dr. Charles Wilkins, and Dr. Anka Sharis on the Persian Card Room. For this and more episodes of the podcast, visit humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu. You can also find us on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. Just search for Humanities Viewpoints. Thanks for listening.